A new housing study offers a grim forecast for some parts of the West. It says areas hit hardest by home foreclosures may never fully recover. As NPR's Karen Grigsby-Bates reports, that raises big questions about the future of some neighborhoods that sprang up during boom times.
This is something that's happening way too infrequently these days.
Cedar-lined closets, lots of built-ins. Fabulous walk-in pantry over there, Butler's pantry.
That's realtor Jody Velto showing potential clients a vacant single-family home in Upland. It's in San Bernardino County, one of California's hardest hit, and like everywhere else, Upland's prices dipped in the past few years. Now buyers slowly are coming back, looking for amenities like these her husband Bill, also a broker, is outlining.
Granite countertops, travertine flooring, stainless steel appliances.
Bill Velto says this neighborhood has fared comparatively well because of its location, just east of L.A. County. It's a reasonable commute, and for some, the price makes the drive worth it.
Well, you know, back in the old day it was go west, my friend, go west. Now it's kind of go east, my friend, go east because of the values.
This house, which listed a few years ago for well over $700,000, sold that day for around $500,000. But in many parts of the country, a sale like this is the exception to the rule. A new study commissioned by the Mortgage Bankers Association's Research Institute for Housing America looked at how plummeting real estate values are dragging down several American cities.
The story's not over, but my sense is that the demand drop is significant and persistent. And for some of these places, it'll be a long time before they fully recover.
Jim Fullane, an economist and senior fellow at the Rockefeller Institute of Government in Albany, authored the study. He says the current housing downturn is reminiscent of the erosion of several industrial cities in the North and Midwest.
Well, I think we believe there might be some insights about the current situation by looking at what I call traditional declining cities, which you think about some of the places in the Rust Belt.
In other words, Stockton, California, and parts of Fresno and many newly built desert communities in Arizona and Nevada seem to be headed where Detroit is now, full of housing that is standing empty. Anne Fullane says, just as it's taken decades for some Rust Belt cities to recover, the same could be true of parts of the country that have suffered severe housing slumps. The current housing mess has adversely affected the American economy for the long term, says John Wasik, author of a book called The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome.
I think the real estate market, at least in residential areas, in some of the worst hit areas, especially in, say, Central and Southern California, are going to be hobbled for at least a generation.
Which means no silver lining in the black cloud hanging over housing. It's a grim forecast, especially for many new developments that sprang up during the boom times. Whole communities were constructed on the field of dreams expectation that if you build it, they will come, especially when financing a house was about as easy as financing a car. Those days are long gone, but John Wasik says hard-hit areas will continue to pay a huge price for those easy money mortgages.
Many people finance without any down payment at all. So those are the people who had no economic stake whatsoever in staying in those properties and subsequently became part of the foreclosure process.
Today, it's possible to find a good deal where there used to be none. But the uncertainty of where prices are headed makes buyers and lenders hesitant, which deepens the problem, says economist Jim Fullane.
And that's the fear, I think, that, will my neighborhood be one that is going to be particularly slow to recover.
Being able to choose a neighborhood that will thrive may mean life or death for a number of American cities going forward. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
And we go now to the windswept high-altitude plains of Bolivia, known as the Altiplano. A food grown there has long been a staple in Bolivia and is now increasingly popular in the U.S. It's called quinoa. It's high in protein and iron, and its recent embrace abroad has pushed up the price of quinoa in Bolivia. It now sells for seven times more than it did just a decade ago. Reporter Annie Murphy has more.
The Bolivian Altiplano doesn't look like good farmland. It doesn't even look fertile.
Everything here is covered in bleached out scrub and rocks. It's a really barren landscape. There are just a few llamas grazing and some whirls of dust.
But this seemingly hostile environment has ideal conditions for quinoa. It's about 2 miles above sea level, sandy and arid. The nearby Uyuni salt flat provides the right minerals, and dung from herds of grazing llamas and sheep mean good fertilizer. Farmer Ernesto Choquetopa admires the soil. He says quinoa's recent popularity is changing farmers' lives.
Antes la gente no estudiaba. Nacía, crecía.
Before, people didn't go to study, he says. They were born, they grew up, and that was it. They went on to herd sheep and llamas, nothing more. Now people here, he says, we think about doing something with our lives. Thanks to his earnings from quinoa, Choquetopa's oldest daughter is now at university studying medicine, and area farmers are increasingly turning to quinoa. Dark green quinoa plants stretch before us in long, spindly rows. They have cone-shaped flowers filled with the edible seeds and look like a cross between broccoli and lupins. Once ready for harvest, they'll turn gold, deep red, even purple. Choquetopa is part of an association of organic farmers, and his harvest will go to their processing plant. Here it's cleaned, rinsed, packaged, and bought by exporters, like Fabricio Nunez, general manager of Andean Organics, which sources quinoa to places like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's.
Once we promoted it and the product was on the shelves, it really started flying off the shelves. People are still looking more and more and more for quinoa, and we're not able to supply it as fast as they wanted.
But for all the health benefits and the way sales support farmers, popularity abroad is raising prices and gradually making it harder for Bolivians to buy quinoa. Nunez says a few years ago, 16 ounces of Andean Organics quinoa retailed for $2 at Trader Joe's. Now it's $4. And if prices keep climbing, quinoa could stop showing up in traditional soups and porridges in Bolivia. But on the street corner in downtown La Paz, quinoa remains a popular breakfast. The delicate curly seeds are served with hot milk and sugar as a thick drink. And at about 30 cents for an 8-ounce cup, it's still cheap, even by Bolivian standards. The Bolivian government is backing quinoa, supporting loans to small farmers, and promoting internal consumption by giving rations to pregnant women and young children. Dr. Margarita Flores works for Bolivia's Ministry of Health and oversees the program. Flores says that a drop in production would worry the government, because Bolivia has obligations at home and abroad to produce quinoa, and because it's part of the country's strategy to fight malnutrition. The challenge is striking a balance. In spite of growing prosperity, many quinoa farmers are concerned about the environment. In Ernesto Choquetopa's community, people who use chemical fertilizers or uproot native grasses around quinoa fields are fined or even punished.
Solamente nosotros queremos mantener.
We want to keep the production sustainable, he says. We don't want to exploit every bit of it. This piece of earth has to support our kids and grandchildren, too. For NPR News, I'm Annie Murphy in Bolivia.
Now let's talk about the cold, hard math of taxes. Illinois lawmakers have voted to drastically increase the state's income tax. Supporters of the move say it's necessary to help reduce the state's estimated $15 billion budget deficit. And Governor Pat Quinn has promised to sign it. NPR's David Shaper reports.
Illinois is a fiscal mess. The budget crisis here is considered the worst in the nation. The state is months behind in paying its bills. And it's not just vendors and social service agencies waiting to be paid, but schools and local governments, too. The state's been borrowing so much and racking up such a huge debt that Illinois' credit rating is now tied with California as the lowest in the country. Calling his state a fiscal house on fire, Democratic Governor Pat Quinn says in order to keep Illinois from becoming fiscally insolvent, the state's residents and businesses need to pay higher taxes.
It's important for the state government not to be a fiscal basket case.
So in the waning moments of a lame duck session early Wednesday, with Quinn's backing but no Republican support and not a single vote to spare, Illinois lawmakers voted to raise the state's personal income tax rate from 3% to 5%. And the corporate tax rate from 4.8% to 7%.
The concept here is this is a temporary income tax to deal with the immediate fiscal emergency our state faces.
The income tax increase would raise close to $7 billion a year, and it caps some state spending. But the new revenue alone won't close Illinois' gaping budget hole, and Illinois Republicans blast majority Democrats for not including significant spending cuts. In the heated floor debate, Republican State Senator Kyle McCarter said the tax hike will kill jobs and cripple businesses in Illinois, with one exception.
Here's an investment tip for you. Put your money in moving vans. They'll be in high demand.
Already, the Republican governors of Wisconsin and Indiana are using Illinois' tax increase as a marketing tool to try to lure Illinois businesses across the border.
Well, lots of luck to them, but that's not going to happen.
An unconcerned Illinois Governor Quinn points out that Wisconsin's income tax rates remain much higher than Illinois'. But that doesn't make this whopping tax increase of almost 67% any easier for Illinois residents to swallow. Even among those waiting in line to meet Governor Quinn at an open house at the governor's mansion after his inauguration earlier this week.
I think that there's a lot that needs to be cleaned up first. Then we should talk about raising the income tax.
Anita Strout-Manis of the Chicago suburb of Deerfield wants to see spending cuts and fixes for the state's pension problems. And as for this tax increase being temporary?
I don't believe that. Once you raise something, it doesn't go down.
But others are willing to pay more to end Illinois' perennial budget crises, including Southern Illinois and Billy Henderson.
I think that would generate a lot of revenue for Illinois. And I think, you know, we've been in trouble for so long, I think it's our responsibility to help get the state back on its feet.
Illinois' income tax increase is retroactive to January 1st, meaning by the time the governor signs it and the revenue department begins collecting, that first paycheck deduction could be quite large. David Shaper, NPR News in Springfield, Illinois.
Now, sometimes the stock market goes up and down for no apparent reason. Happens often, actually, and our Planet Money team wondered why. So they tried an experiment based on an idea written down 75 years ago. Here's NPR's David Kestenbaum.
A beauty contest. That is how the famous and somewhat eccentric economist John Maynard Keynes described the stock market in 1936. The contest he imagined worked like this. You get a bunch of photos of women's faces and have people vote. The game is to try to pick the winner. Not necessarily who you think is the prettiest, but who you think everyone else will pick.
It made sense to me immediately, and I thought it had such interesting implications.
This is Pietra Rivoli, professor at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. If you think about it, this beauty contest, it is just like the stock market. It makes sense to try to pick the stock you think everyone else will pick, even if you believe the company is a disaster, because if everyone else picks it, the stock's price will rise. Keynes wrote about the beauty contest. It's not about picking the prettiest faces, quote, nor even those that average opinion genuinely thinks the prettiest. We have reached the third degree, where we devote our intelligences to anticipating what average opinion expects the average opinion to be.
He's talking about sort of some kind of strange exponential psychological process where I'm trying to figure out what you think and you're trying to figure out what the next guy thinks and that guy's trying to figure out what the other guy thinks. And the key danger is that nobody's really thinking.
With Pietro's guidance, we tested this out with an online experiment. Instead of a beauty contest, we set up a cuteness contest with three animals. 12,000 people participated. When they came to our website, they were presented with three videos: a kitten being tickled, a slow loris, that's a primate with big eyes, and a baby polar bear. Half the people in the experiment were asked to pick the animal they genuinely thought was the cutest, and half were asked to pick the animal they thought everyone else would find the cutest. Pietra was in the first group. What do you think is cutest?
I picked the polar bear. I liked the white fur, and I also thought that the whole skating on your belly on the ice thing was adorable.
And here is someone from Group B, Marla Wood, a listener from Colorado.
I actually had a hard time finding any of them particularly cute, honestly.
What did you think was the cutest first?
I guess the loris was the cutest.
So, but you were asked to pick the animal you thought everyone else would pick as the cutest.
Yes, correct.
So what did you pick?
I chose the cat, the kitten, I should say, for two reasons. One was it was the least appealing to me, which I find is generally the case. I'm always on the outside, in my opinion.
Marla picked the kitten, even though, personally, she found it the least cute. Imagine if this were to happen in the stock market. What if the market was entirely filled with Marlas, right? Then basically, you know, there's a huge kitten bubble, and no one actually thinks kittens are cute.
And there we have the subprime.
The subprime housing bubble. Even if you thought it was a bubble, there was still someone else willing to buy, so it made sense to stay in the game. All right, here are the results from our experiment. People in Group A asked what they thought was the cutest. The kitten was the winner. People in Group B asked what they thought everyone else would pick. 75% did get it right, the kitten, but 25% got it wrong. They thought the loris or baby polar bear would win. If this were a cute animal stock market, that could throw off prices. Pietro Rivoli says when she hears on the news about the stock market doing this or that, she sometimes thinks, beauty contest.
There's been some academic research on this that says, you know, there's a lot of price movement in individual stocks and in the market as a whole that we can't explain, with kind of fundamental rational stories.
This does not mean the stock market is totally nuts. Over long stretches of time, she says, even John Maynard Keynes would probably argue the stock market gets things right. All bubbles eventually pop. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.